C'est un très, très grand plaisir et honneur d'accueillir Paul Nurse ici pour faire une série de séminaires, de cours, enfin de présentations qui vont être, à partir d'aujourd'hui, très philosophiques jusqu'à quelque chose de très mécanistique et moléculaire. Mais avant de commencer, je voulais quand même dire quelques mots sur Paul. Je vais peut-être par politesse passer en anglais pour qu'il comprenne ce que je vais dire. D'ailleurs, je vais dire une chose en français avant de passer en anglais parce qu'il ne comprend pas le français. C'est que donc, ce Paul est un très, très grand scientifique et le français a failli l'empêcher de faire la science. Il va peut-être vous raconter ça, mais c'était un peu difficile au début, le français. Et du coup, je pense que pour lui, c'est vraiment... très beau de pouvoir venir parler avec vous au Collège de France en anglais. Okay, now I'll switch to English. But I did tell them the story about the fact that, yes, your French was not the easiest of your topics early on. Tu comprends, ouais. So Paul Nurse is a geneticist by training, a cell biologist as well, and... his studies from very, very early days were to try and understand, as a geneticist, cell biologist, and I guess microbiologist, how reproduction works, which I found rather surprising as a way to describe the onset of his scientific career. But these are the terms that he used in his Nobel Prize lecture. And by reproduction, Paul decided to try and understand how a cell reproduces itself, how one cell gives rise to two, and how all of this is controlled, his work on the cell cycle, and how the proteins and the molecules that regulate this process actually work. And he has not ceased since his PhD, and even before then, to be an experimentalist. He says himself that he is very much an experimentalist and an empiricist, but someone who is dedicated to trying to get to the truth, to find out how things work, and is fascinated by life, as you will hear in the course of the lectures that he'll give. So Paul Nurse started his studies very early on, actually, as a child, walking through natural environments. I won't go into the details of the plants and stars that he explored, but he decided to go on, having managed to get to university despite French, to become a scientist and to do a PhD at the University of East Anglia. And then he moved to Edinburgh, then to the University of Sussex, where he actually set up his first lab. And then he moved to the Imperial Cancer Research Fund, where he did many of his seminal studies that led to the prize that he won, the Nobel Prize in 2001. And I should say that it was actually while Paul Nurse was at the ICRF in the late 1980s that I first came across him. I was very lucky, actually, because Paul Nurse almost went to work at the EMBL. They offered him a job, and he declined because he didn't feel that he wanted to move to Heidelberg. He preferred to stay in London. And if he had taken up that job, I never would have met Paul, probably, or not at that stage in my career. So I was a student, a PhD student, and I have to admit that the ICRF at that time was an amazing place where you could sense the excitement of discovery that Paul and his lab, actually, as well as others at the time, were generating. It was a truly amazing experience to see the power of scientific approach and discovery that was happening right then with unraveling of the Wee mutants and all that came. And I will not go into all the details. In any case, after a few years at the ICRF, Paul decided to go to Oxford, where he took on an even bigger role. And then he moved back to the ICRF, where he became the director. And after several years of very, very successful direction, he was eventually lured, actually, to the United States, where he became the president of the Rockefeller. And while he was there, I think, started to hatch the idea of creating an amazing institute in London that would be unique in many ways in what it brought together, the Francis Crick Institute. So Paul was, I would say, very much behind the inception and the whole implementation of the Crick Institute, which has been a huge success, and one can already see the incredible science that's coming out of there, including many, many young, dynamic scientists who go there and manage to explore the science that they want to explore, to discover, and in the meantime, also carry out work that has applications and is translational. So I wanted to just say that Paul Nurse has been an inspiration to many, many people around me, I know, but to me as well in particular, both as a scientist, but also as a human being. He has a very philosophical approach to life. He's very pragmatic. I guess that's slightly the British side of him. But he's also a fervent European and someone who has been extremely supportive in the last few years, where so much has happened. And as we know today, so much is still happening. So for all of that, I would say Paul, for me, is one of the grands hommes of science of today, who is doing science not just for the sake of discovery, but also for the sake of humanity. So I just wanted to end not by citing the very, very long list of prizes and accolades that Paul has. I think we all know some of them. He even has the Légion d'honneur, but you know, several others as well. I just wanted to end, actually, by the words that he himself used at the end of his lecture, which for the Nobel Prize, which I found very, very inspiring. So apologies, Paul, if you were going to say this. You probably weren't, but okay. So what he said was, "I have an idealistic view of science as a liberalizing and progressive force for humanity. Better understanding of the natural world not only enhances all of us as human beings, but can also be harnessed for the better good, leading to improved health and quality of life. It's also a truly international activity, which breaks down barriers between the peoples of this world, an objective that always has been necessary and never more so than now." This was in 2001. "Scientific understanding is often beautiful, a profoundly aesthetic experience which gives pleasure, not unlike the reading of a great poem. It's been a privilege to pursue knowledge for its own sake and to see how it might help mankind in more practical ways. And I hope that the future will allow me to continue that pursuit for as long as I am able." And Paul is very much able, as we will be hearing in today's lecture and those that will follow. Paul, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to have you here.
I just want to start by saying it's such a pleasure to be here. I haven't been in France for 2.5 years. Before that, I was always coming. It's a pleasure to see you all here, and thank you for coming. It's an honour to be here to speak in the Collège de France, one of those great intellectual institutions of the world. And it is a pleasure to see that maybe we're beginning to emerge into something approaching normality. This is the first of 4 lectures I'm going to give over the coming months in the Collège. The first 2 are more focused on general issues, for the general public, science's revolution, which is this evening, what is life, and then 2 which reflect my science interests over the years, on the logic of cell cycle control and the molecular mechanisms of cell cycle control. But tonight, it's science as revolution. And let's see. Right, as revolution. Not sure that's entirely appropriate today, to be perfectly honest. I should probably have Robespierre up there, I suppose. But anyway, I did it before. Today, or this week. Science as revolution. When we think of revolutions, we usually think of major transformations, of course, in the sphere of politics, of economics, of social organization, or even religion. And, for example, here, Lenin in the Russian Revolution. I put Lenin up there, I have to say, because I live in Clerkenwell, and he used to live in the street next door to me as a little plaque on the wall. But to these sorts of revolutions, I want to add the revolutions brought about by science, both cultural, as you heard from my earlier quote, through improved knowledge of the natural world and also of ourselves, and also through the impact that that improved knowledge has on the development of human civilization, the utilitarian use of science. And in this lecture, I want to argue that science is in fact the most long-lasting revolutionary activity known to humankind. And that is because science generates systematic knowledge that stands the test of time. And as a result, science has long-standing consequences for society and acts as a major driver of culture and civilization, as I've said, and of changes in the ways that we live. And I want to illustrate some of these revolutionary advances over thousands of years, in fact, by tracing the development of science from its first glimmerings in prehistory, which I have to imagine, through to today, arguing that revolutions in science have been of great benefit of humanity. There's complications too, of course. And if science is properly nurtured and used well, it will continue to bring great benefits in the future. So I want to start with the question, why is science such a reliable way of generating systematic knowledge? It is because of the way that it's done. There is no such thing, I think, as a scientific method, but it is based on a range of attributes and ways of working, not necessarily unique to science, in fact, but which are combined together in science in a very effective way. Science is based on reliable and reproducible observations, generating accurate descriptions of how the natural world behaves. Such evidence, this scientific evidence, forms the bedrock of science. The impetus to make observations and to carry out experiments mostly derives from curiosity, human curiosity, natural in children, and often persisting at a high level later in the lives of many scientists. From the study of these observations, these experiments, regularities and patterns can be recognized, which in turn lead to ideas and hypotheses to explain the workings of the world. This requires an attitude of mind that the natural world is in principle explicable. In principle, you can understand it. And it's not the consequence of capricious supernatural forces. That's a major transition, in fact. I shall speak a bit more about that later. Explanations in science have predictive power. Particularly in physics, the use of mathematics has been key to generating great precision in these predictions. Scientific explanations are often reductionist. That is, they look for understanding of natural phenomena at lower levels of organization, although this should always be in the context of the behavior of the whole system. Imagination and intuition are important in generating scientific ideas and these hypotheses that then can be tested with more observations and experiments. Now, this way of working has been well described by the philosopher of science, Karl Popper. I want to say goodbye to Lenin. Yes, here we have Karl Popper, who emphasized the importance of trial and error in science. What did he argue? He argued that a scientist considers the data obtained by observations and experiments which are relevant to the phenomenon of interest. And then through leaps is the word he uses, through leaps of the imagination and intuition, develops a framework to consider that data and generates hypotheses to explain the phenomenon. These hypotheses are then tested by using them to make new predictions, which are then examined by further experiments and observations. And now this is critical. If the data do not support that hypothesis, then it's either rejected or it's modified, and the new hypothesis is tested by yet further observation and experiment. So that's what he means by science proceeding by trial and error, with unsatisfactory hypotheses being rejected through a process of what he calls falsification. Actually, he goes further. Popper goes further to argue that the ability to falsify is the principal way of distinguishing science from non-science. And of course, an important implication of that statement of how science works is that scientific knowledge evolves. It's often tentative, especially at the beginning of an investigation where you know very little about the topic. We saw that at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. It is only after repeated testing that it becomes more secure. Of course, at school, we're taught that it's always secure, which is one of the big problems of communicating science to the public. Science is also influenced by the way scientists behave and interact one with another in a community. Scientists should be open, honest, rigorous in their thinking, skeptical, especially skeptical of their own ideas. An effective science community should be interactive and collaborative and encourage the constant challenge of data, ideas, and hypotheses. It's the overall strength of the evidence and argument that matters in science, not the hierarchical authority of the scientists involved. Now, I'm a bit of an idealist, and I know that what I've just described is a community of saints. So I've argued what scientists should be. I fully recognise they aren't always like that. Perhaps they aren't often like that, but that's what we have to aspire to. This combination and these attributes and ways of working produces a methodology that underpins science and is very effective at generating reliable knowledge. And of course, many of the things I've said would apply to other disciplines, like history, for example. So when did scientific thinking, when did this sort of thinking begin? When were the first observations made that allowed recognition of regularities and patterns to be recognised, for ideas, explanations to be generated? So now I'm going to use my imagination. It's possible to detect, I think, scientific processes in prehistory, and good examples being the revolutionary changes which led to agriculture and metallurgy, and in the construction of astronomically oriented ritualistic structures, such as in England, Stonehenge, and the extraordinary monuments that you have in Caen and in the west of France. Absolutely amazing, if you've not been. I'm going to try and imagine what the impulses were which gave rise to those. Now, the agricultural revolution, let's start there, was dependent upon the domestication of wild plants, the selection and cultivation of crop plants with desirable characteristics. First came about 10,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East, when the cultivation of cereals, wheat and barley, and then later in the New World with maize, and of course in the East with rice. It requires continuous cultivation and experimental trait selection to generate cereals with large grains and low seed dormancy that were convenient to harvest. And this can be seen if we look at the development of the maize crop from Teosinte, the wild precursor plant here. You see the modern corn and where it came from. Now, I imagine that some observant hunter-gatherer thousands of years ago must have noticed unusual, rare plants with desirable characteristics growing amongst a mass of normal plants. Perhaps what that hunter-gatherer observed might have been something like, something like this photograph I took a couple of years ago in spring in a wood outside Oxford, and note this white bluebell embedded in a mass of bluebells. Noticing something different, paying attention to it, isolating it, growing it. The curiosity, because it must have been based on curiosity, of such proto-scientists, their recognition of the potential usefulness of more unusual plants must have led to the collection of seeds, subsequent propagation of those derived plants. Over hundreds or probably thousands of years, more proto-scientists would go on and select for better combinations until gradually the agricultural revolution was born. Not eating bluebells, of course, but I mean using the same principle. And this occurred, of course, not just once, but as I've indicated, a number of times throughout the world with different crops. And I find it difficult to imagine this happening unless these creative and innovative individuals were employing what we would now recognise as a scientific approach, using careful observation, recognising regularities and patterns within those observations, and using that to decide what to do next. It must have been natural for at least some of our distant Homo sapiens forebears to think and to act like this, the beginning scientists. Later than the agricultural revolution, similar impulses with metallurgy 5,000 to 8,000 years ago. A society dependent upon stone, bone, and wood for its materials was desperate for metal. Metal for tools, metal for implements, metal inevitably for weapons. Smelting requires metal ore and high temperatures. Once again, I imagine an observant individual who noticed that heating a copper ore produced material that could be usefully fashioned to make tools and implements. Maybe burning the charcoal produced from the day before in a campfire made on a ground containing copper ore accidentally generated the temperature to produce copper. Once done, it was noticed. And once noticed, it was repeated. Then 2,000 years later, someone else smelted copper ore contaminated with tin to generate the more versatile bronze shown here. Another revolution in technology. And once again, this must have involved individuals observing carefully, recognizing regularities. These advances were not always utilitarian in character. Our prehistory proto-scientists were also observing and studying the heavens above them, particularly the movement of the sun and the stars as the seasons changed. They observed regularities. And these regularities were incorporated in great ritual structures aligned to important celestial events such as the longest day. The alignment of the heelstone and the stone circle here of Stonehenge, which corresponds to the summer solstice, is one of the best known examples. But even more extraordinary for me is this one here, the entrance to the Newgrange Barrow in Ireland, through which light from the sun penetrates the depths of the tomb around the winter solstice. A box was created over the entrance, and the sun shines through there and lights up the bones at the back of the chamber, and does it every year. This is just, to me, extraordinary. They knew this would happen. It meant something to them, ritualistically, of course, but it also was built on knowledge, even profound knowledge, as well as building skills to produce that. Although proto-science can be detected, I think, in prehistory, it's more clearly articulated in the writings from classical Greece. The Ionian period, particularly the town of Miletus, although these are not Greek ruins, they're Roman ruins, I have to say. There's no Greek ruins left. Around 600 BC, produced Thales, who provided explanations of the origin of the world, for example. Here's an imagined head of Miletus. Now, critically, what these Greek scientists were doing was generating explanatory accounts which did not involve intervention from the gods. And I want to emphasize that because they differed from how civilizations had thought about these things in the past. They did not invoke divine creators, as, for example, in the earlier Sumerian, Egyptian, or Babylonian creationist myths. Instead, they proposed that the planets had some material basis. They argued, quite incorrectly, that the planets were globes of fires in the heavens rather than gods wandering in the sky. The important point is not that they were right or wrong, but they were looking for explanations which was rational and did not derive from the supernatural. They were assuming that the world, in principle, is understandable, is explicable. and can be understood by the rational workings of the human mind. And this is a truly revolutionary step. We can understand the world. Now, unfortunately, not all in ancient Greece were happy with this entirely rational approach. This is a painting by David in the Met in New York, and it's a painting of Socrates committing suicide. He was condemned by the political leadership in Athens to commit suicide by drinking hemlock for corrupting the Athenian youth with his denial of the existence of the gods. They argue this is Plato in the back there escaping because he couldn't bear to see Socrates die. Two other features of science were developed by the ancient Greeks: the systematic description of nature, as pursued by the encyclopedist Aristotle, and the carrying out of experiments as described by Strato, the physicist. The consequence of all of this was an explosion of both ideas and scientific understanding, some of which remains important today, 2.5 millennia later. Aristotle provided the descriptive basis of biology, and together with his followers, founded his philosophical school, the Lyceum. You can consider it the first scientific research institute, or the first university, if you prefer. Democritus proposed a theoretical atomistic model for matter, anticipating the atomic theories of Dalton 2,000 years later. Aristarchus argued for a sun-centered heliocentric planetary system, although this was not widely accepted until 1,500 years or more later, after Copernicus and Galileo. Eratosthenes not only concluded the Earth was spherical, but by simple reasoning, calculated the diameter of the Earth by measuring the length of shadows in different parts of Egypt, separated by a known distance, and simple trigonometry allowed him to do it. So simple, so extraordinary, and got the diameter of the Earth to within, I think, around 10%. I mean, completely extraordinary. So Archimedes, he founded the science of mechanics, although his work was tragically terminated by a Roman soldier at the siege of Syracuse. It has to be said, the Romans do rather less well than the Greeks in the history of science. They were good at roads, though. We have to give them that. And actually buildings just down the road, of course. The Greeks brought about, however, a revolution in ideas that changed our world forever. They introduced the concept the world was comprehensible. They liberated humanity from the yoke of mysticism and superstition. They brought about long-lasting changes in our knowledge of the natural world. They started the development of mechanical technologies and of medicine for the benefit of humankind. Others, of course, had done that. We see that in Egypt as well. But these were revolutions that began the long journey to the Enlightenment, an Enlightenment which I argue still mostly exists today. Not completely, but mostly. Realizing that the workings of the natural world could be understood meant that a careful observation and experiment could be gathered to provide knowledge of the world that could be useful to help society. In England, at the turn of the 17th century, Francis Bacon, shown here, courtier, statesman, and philosopher, was laying out his approach to science. This is in the 1620s. A little after the college, if I remember correctly. He emphasized the need for the gathering of reliable information and taking account of these particulars to then formulate what he called generalities, noting when the occurrence of specific particulars were correlated with specific outcomes and when they were not. He famously argued, and this is one of my favorite quotes from him, for a skeptical approach in the pursuit of knowledge, saying, if a man will begin with certainties, oh, I should say in the early 17th century there were no women, by the way, I should mention that. If a man will begin with certainties, he shall end in doubts. But if he will be content to begin with doubts, he shall end in certainties. Say it every morning when you wake up. Say it, Mr. Putin, when you wake up tomorrow. He advocated also that knowledge is power, and that establishing a legitimate command over nature leads to the release of man's estate. In other words, science is useful. However, it would have perhaps been best if he had confined himself to thinking about science rather than doing science. During winter, when he was driving just to the north of London, it was snowing, he stopped his carriage and bought a hen to stuff it with snow to see if it would delay putrefaction of the bird. As a consequence of his outdoor experiment, he caught a chill, developed bronchitis, and died several days later. Meanwhile, at the same time, but in the warmer climate of Italy, Galileo was more successful with his experiments and observations. His work, studying the motions of balls descending inclined planes, established mechanics as science, and importantly linked physics with mathematics, with his statement that the book of nature is written in mathematical characters. Certainly true for physical nature. But it was his acute practical observations combined with his rationalism which led to the revolution that provided eventually the evidence that moved the Earth from being the center of the universe to a planet circling the sun. This began a process whereby our terrestrial globe has become an increasingly insignificant. It's become increasingly insignificant to just a speck in the universe. Our sun is a star, just one of billions in our galaxy. And our galaxy is just one amongst the billions that make up the universe. And maybe there are even countless universes. And this revolution started here, when Galileo turned his simple telescope towards the planet Jupiter, discovered the Medici stars, circling Jupiter, named after his former pupil and subsequent employer, the Duke of Tuscany. Clearly, not all celestial objects were orbiting the Earth. Some, and you see his pictures here, circled another planet over there, Jupiter. This led observational support to the heliocentric views of Copernicus. It, of course, eventually led to his conflict with the Catholic Church, and for that matter with the Protestant Church too. Luther was no fan of Galileo, who were concerned that the Copernican system, this is back to the Catholic Church, would have worse consequences than both Luther and Calvin together. Galileo was forced to recant his ideas, possibly after encouragement by being shown the instruments of torture. They just showed them, but that's what they speculate. Science doesn't always comfortably sit with politics or with religion or ideologies that do not respect the primacy of evidence and of rational argument. This marked really the first stirrings of the Enlightenment that Kant would eventually describe as the emergence of man from his self-imposed infancy, by which he meant that humankind gained the resolve and the courage to use reason to understand the world, following the Roman poet Horace, dare to know, dare to know. That sentiment was central to the founding of the Royal Society in 1660, which ushered in the age of modern science. Its motto, you can see on the left, nullius in verba, roughly translated as take no one's word for it. It was actually a pushback on the scholastic tradition of the Middle Ages that we needed to base what we know on observation and experiment, on demonstrated observation experiment, and not established authority, and not what you read in texts, and particularly not what you read in texts from Aristotle, which of course was very predominant at the time. The early pinnacle of success for modern science, based on mathematics to understand physics, was the work of Isaac Newton over there, an early president of the Royal Society, whose laws of motion led to the idea of universal gravitation. It provided a quantitative description of the motions of visible bodies, demonstrating that the motion of a small terrestrial object, such as an apple falling from a tree, was subject to the same laws that applied to the motion of large celestial objects like planets orbiting the sun. Edith and myself, last week, actually, visiting the Royal Society, were shown the manuscript that first described the apple falling from the tree, which the Society has in its archives. Newton's laws didn't provide a mechanism for gravity, by the way. What it provided was the universality and scope of the law of gravitation had predictive power and allowed great precision in calculations. And it was a revolutionary view that, again, the world could be understood by reason to the very finest detail. Discoveries such as these also lead to important applications. Robert Hooke, who also contributed to ideas about gravitation, although he was expunged from history by the oversensitive Newton. They say he even burnt his, after he died, burnt his paintings of him, because he dared speculate about gravity at the same time as the great Newton. Anyway, what Hooke said, was scientific discoveries concerning motion, light, gravity, and magnetism, all of interest to a 17th century scientist, and of the heavens, helped to improve shipping, watches, optics, and engines for trade and carriage, also of great interest to the 17th century. They were linked. Something to think about when we make these distinctions between so-called pure science and applied science. They're always linked. Always linked. Once again, science is revolutionary, changes our view of the world, changes what we can do in the world. Knowledge of the movements of celestial bodies was central to navigation. That, in turn, was needed for journeys across the globe, yet another revolutionary step in the history of humankind that depended, at least in part, upon science. Stephen Shapin is a historian and sociologist of science, and he's emphasised another, perhaps less well-recognised aspect of why the Royal Society strongly influenced the birth of modern science, is that it generated a way of working which led to a scientific culture or sociology. Science was open more to many more professions and those of different religions and to those of different races and classes for a 17th century situation. It wasn't good with women, as I've already indicated, and indeed the society did not elect women to the society till the 1940s. Extraordinary, but I'm afraid true. However, for its time, the society was inclusive and reasonably tolerant and international in its outlook, providing a community to promote discussion, criticism, advice, and commentaries. It was invented one of the first scientific journals, Philosophical Transactions. There was also one set up in Paris as well around the same time. And that incorporated the concept of criticism and reviewing from peers, peer review. The society emphasized the importance of the public demonstration of experiments so that scientists had to provide sufficient information for work to be replicated elsewhere before it was to be accepted. And these practices are crucial today even for the proper pursuit of science. And these were established in the late 17th century and are often overshadowed by specific discoveries like Newton's, where it is actually the process of science which was put in place. Robert Boyle, another founding fellow of the Society, I'm sorry if I'm banging on about the Royal Society so much, but I was president of it, so excuse me for that. Robert Boyle argued that experiments should be reliable and reproducible and be properly witnessed by others. The principle here is, of course, that the pursuit of the scientific endeavour should embrace the communication of advances widely and publicly and also encourage debate. And what emerged from this is the importance of the development of consensus opinions amongst the scientific community, and then, of course, debate and attack of those consensus opinions as well. Most of the time, the ideas, if they and the hypotheses, if they're not of much value, they fail to spread. Although occasionally lobbyists will try to promote views in the lay public arena, and that can happen in important scientific areas, important for public policy, and obviously, as known as to us all, climate science suffered greatly from that in a decade or more ago. The Enlightenment, the Royal Society, the other scientific academies, including here in Paris, set modern science on its way. The consequence of this was knowledge that formed the technological basis for the Industrial Revolution that developed in the 18th and 19th centuries, and as I said, continues today. This cannot be overestimated. It literally underpins the making of the modern world. The advances were really extraordinary. The development, I just list, development of new energy sources with steam, electricity, internal combustion engines, now nuclear and renewable sources of power. The use of new materials, iron, steel, ceramics, plastics. The invention of efficient machines of manufacture, such as the power loom, the spinning jenny, leading to the modern robotized factory of today. New means of transport, the railway, locomotive, the steamship, the automobile, the aeroplane, the spaceship. Advances in communication and the management of information with the telegraph, the radio, the television, the computer, the World Wide Web. Extraordinary. There's nothing we do that hasn't been touched by science and technologies that are driven by that science. But of course, unfortunately, together with these advances for the good of humankind, there have been the construction of increasingly more effective and deadly weapons of war. It really is difficult to imagine any aspect of our present lives which has not been influenced by these developments. They've brought revolutionary changes, I use the word again, to everyone on the globe. The Industrial Revolution was mainly based on physical sciences, but the life sciences contributed too. Scientific approaches gradually increased agricultural production such that crop yields today for each acre of land under cultivation is 8 to 10 times higher than in the earlier 18th century. We forget that, 8 to 10 times higher. The life sciences brought about further new ideas and concepts, which led to revolutionary changes to established opinion and orthodoxy, no more so than in, of course, the idea of evolution. This is Charles Darwin, recognizable to everybody. It was his painstaking observations, meticulous arguments, that made the case for evolution. It had been made before, including in France, Buffon, for example, and Lamarck. He argued that living organisms have evolved and are related by descent. He postulated a major mechanism for evolution, that is natural selection. And he demonstrated that the life sciences could be understood in terms of universal laws, just like the physical sciences. And as Darwin himself recognized with his famous last sentence in The Origin of Species, clearly referring back to Newton, he finishes The Origin with the following sentence: whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity, Newton, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. I wish we could write papers like that now. You can read it 200 years later and it still is interesting. I can't read what I wrote 2 months after I'd been published and find it interesting. By the time I've edited it, somebody else has edited it, it's pat. I think we should return to the mid-19th century for our writing. That's an aside. But most importantly, and still contentious for some today, Darwin's ideas, rather like the movement of the Earth from being the centre of the universe, Darwin's ideas moved human beings from being specially created to being related to the rest of the living world. And just as Copernicus had moved the Earth from being the centre of the universe, Darwin moved humankind from a unique position separate from the rest of life. He also demonstrated that science advances by good ideas, but is completely dependent upon reliable and reproducible observation and experiment. It is from such evidence that science draws its strength. Another great advance of the 19th century with revolutionary consequences was forged by John Dalton, a nonconformist teacher of humble origins from Manchester in the northwest of England. By the study of gases, the measurement of relative weights of elements, he gathered evidence in favour of the existence of particulate atoms, increasing in mass by unitary increments. He proposed that atoms combine together in simple ratios to produce molecules. And these experiments gave the first experimental support, for the 2,000-year-old atomic speculations of non-divisible units proposed essentially on philosophical grounds by Democritus as the ultimate structure of matter. Once again, scientific ideas to be accepted require evidence. Took to Einstein, by the way, until that really was put to bed. Dalton's work illustrated another aspect of science, which I briefly mentioned. The strength of explaining a natural phenomenon in terms of the behaviour of components acting at simpler levels. Many scientific explanations are expressed in these reductionist terms. Now, some consider reductionism in an antagonistic way, antagonistic to holism, which emphasises the whole behaviour of the system responsible for the phenomenon under study. I think this is misplaced, this argument, because reductionist explanations are extremely powerful and, in any case, to be fully effective, have to be placed in a holistic context. I think it's a false argument. We can have an argument about it later, if you like, but I think we need both approaches. They are mutually reinforcing. Dalton's achievements, together with the great chemist Lavoisier, another painting by David in New York of the great chemist Lavoisier, laid the foundations of chemistry and of the chemical industry with revolutionary consequences of society through the development of new materials and chemical agents for practical purposes. Great painting, actually. It's my most favourite painting of a scientist. David, by the way, painted this 10 years before Lavoisier lost his head. And you probably know David was on the committee that actually condemned Lavoisier for execution 10 years later. Pathos, really. A second scientific advance of the 19th century, built on the power of reductionism, came from the plant breeding experiments of the Czech monk Grigor Mendel from Brno, who was abbot of Brno. His experiment, and by the way, I visited that monastery many times, including in the Cold War. It was basically a scientific institute. It's extraordinary. You know, he had a gigantic glasshouse, huge garden, and the monks, the monastery supported it. It was looking at the works of God and studying how it worked. I mean, it really was quite extraordinary. And this is, of course, in the middle of the 19th century. His experiments also led to particulate explanations, this time of heredity. That is, inheritance is based on non-divisible units, the units we now call genes. Now, this was a revolutionary advance. It spawned the discovery after discovery in biology and biomedicine in the 20th century. Mendel didn't quite get it right. It took another 30 years and three plant geneticists in the early 1900s to get it completely right. But it was an extraordinary advance, working completely alone, and by the way, completely ignored and completely neglected. Genes were found to be made of DNA, actually in Rockefeller University, where I used to work, and the double helical structure determined in Cambridge and London later, gave rise to the idea that DNA is a digital information storage device, which is the way to think about it. And hence the whole edifice of molecular biology was born, which underpins much of our understanding of modern medicine and life in general. Molecular biology is built on genetics, it's built on biochemistry, and on the view that the phenomena of life can be best understood in terms of information. I've long thought that the life sciences are based both on chemistry and physics, but also information. Biology is an informational science as well as a biochemical one. Louis Pasteur laid the foundations, the great man here, for the biochemical mechanistic explanation of life with his studies in northern France of sugar beet fermentation by yeast. An applied piece of work, by the way, to help the fermenters, but applied work from which he concluded that chemical transformations are a physiological characteristic of life. In other words, life is chemistry. Pasteur's work undermined the concept of vitalism by proposing that the functioning of living things could be understood in terms of physics and chemistry. This conceptual advance ushered in a new dawn of explanations in the phenomena of life with great impacts on modern medicine and also, of course, industry such as the pharmaceutical industry. The revolutionary influence of these advances has really been extraordinary with respect to human health. One fact I think we sometimes forget, just over 100 years ago, even in highly developed countries in Western Europe, life expectancy was around 50 years. A lot of that to do with infant mortality, of course. This was probably only an increase of 15 years since the agricultural revolution, 10,000 years previously. Yet, in that period, the last 120 years, life expectancy is now increased to over 80 years. And that is mostly due to the science and the applications of science. I know things that seem prosaic, like better sewage and so on, have been very important, but that is based on scientific knowledge. It's truly revolutionary, both for the well-being of us individuals and the whole demographic structure of society. We're all much more elderly now than we would have been 100 years or more ago. I'm nearly finished, if you're getting tired. Deep breaths, I always say at this stage. I'll soon be done. Modern physics had another type of impact, which is also revolutionary on the nature of human knowledge. Einstein, in his theory of general relativity, proposed a continuum of space-time which did account for gravity in a way that Newton's ideas did not, which undermined the common sense view of the world expressed in terms of time and three dimensions of space, the Kantian view of the world. Now, apart from brilliant reasoning, Einstein's approach meant that the drive of science to predict and explain natural phenomena resulted in a theory that was no longer completely in accord with our common sense. That is, it's a Kantian view, it's the common sense view, that inherent to our framework of experience and understanding are time and the three dimensions of space. And, of course, Einstein challenged that view. 20 years later, after Einstein, studies of atomic structure led to quantum mechanics. And frankly, now we're in an Alice in Wonderland world. It's a world where Schrödinger's cats can be alive and dead at the same time. This doesn't really sound like common sense. But despite not being explicable in terms of a common sense understanding of the natural world, the subsequently developed standard model of atomic physics has led to extraordinary precision in predictability of the behaviours of the ultimate constituents of matter. This is yet a further revolutionary shift, this time a shift in our understanding of thinking and of human knowledge, where explanations work beautifully, but are beyond our common sense understanding. That's why when you go to a bookshop, you'll see book after book on Einstein's theory and quantum mechanics. You will read them, they are full of metaphors, you think you've understood them, you close the book and it floats away. It floats away because it isn't part of our common sense world. I learnt this, my daughter is a high energy physicist, she works at CERN, or did work at CERN, and she doesn't understand it either. They know how to manipulate it, but it isn't understanding in the sense of how we think about it. I think where physics leads, biology sometimes follows. And I wonder whether the complexity of living organisms will also lead to strange and non-intuitive explanations which have predictive power, but which are no longer part of our common sense world. We could have a discussion about artificial intelligence in that context, if you like. It should also be noted that these physics studies led to nuclear power and the nuclear bomb, which still has truly revolutionary impacts on society. Look at Ukraine today. Why does nothing here happen? We know it is related ultimately to the nuclear bomb. Politics in the second half of the 20th century and today were dominated by the Cold War and the threat of mutually assured mass destruction. And the effects of this, of science and on global politics, have been huge. I have argued in this lecture that science is truly revolutionary, back to Lenin, more so than revolutions based on politics or ideology, because science leads to advances that result in sustained revolutionary changes in both our knowledge to human society, the way we live, and to human culture. It's also important to realize, and actually this does reflect what Edith read out, what I said in that lecture, it's important to realize that advances in science are global in their impact. The knowledge obtained is universal in character. It does not respect differences between countries and cultures. It aims to be applicable throughout the world, throughout humanity. And in this respect, it runs counter to the views of relativists, a constant discussion that, of course, we have. An implication also of this, that science is truly a global activity and has globally transformative effects, is that science thrives on the permeability and fluidity of ideas and of people, of ready exchange of those ideas and people, and of mutual respect of ideas and people. Doesn't mean by mutual respect you don't attack, you don't argue, but you respect the individual who makes the arguments. Cultural differences do result in different ways of doing science. It can be complementary and reinforcing, but ultimately the processes of science are across the globe. Because of these common values, I think science provides a diplomatic tool that can be used to break down barriers between people and nations, and it is not used sufficiently across the world. I'm going to finish now by just asking the question, how can science can continue to bring about revolutionary improvements in the human condition? A critical condition has to be a healthy relationship between science and society. We need to ensure that science is used for the public good and not for the reverse, as it can also be used. Ultimately, making good decisions about the use of knowledge based on science depends on societies with the right values that encourage debate, that are sceptical, that are democratic. For science to play its proper role, it requires a public at ease with science that can cope with the complex decisions involving science. Now, I'm optimistic that in the future, society will increasingly see the values of science in bringing about revolutionary changes to our knowledge and revolutionary improvements in society and the human condition. I conclude, science is truly the most long-lasting revolutionary activity known to humankind, and I hope and believe will continue to bring great benefits to us all. And thank you very much for listening to me.